All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of USIP, the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program in particular, I'd like to welcome you all on this hot and humid day to, air conditioning comfort. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer in the Fellowship Program, and I'll also be serving as the moderator. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with our Project Report series, just let me mention that each spring and summer we invite our current senior fellows to give public presentations on their research and progress like the one today. And we do this for at least two reasons. First, so that we can get a good glimpse of the particular fellows' research, and also, and I think more importantly, so that the fellows themselves can hear your questions and comments, which I think can only enrich the quality of their research. So we very much look forward to hearing the questions and the comments that you have after the presentation. It's my pleasure, great pleasure, to formally introduce Senior Fellow Jayarai Acharya. He's been with us this year working on a project looking at diplomatic approaches to bringing about peace in Nepal. Needless to say, we've been delighted to have him here with us this year, and especially today, so that he can share with us his research. Now, prior to coming to USIP, Ajaya was a foreign policy advisor and speechwriter to Prime Minister G.P. Koirala from 1991 to 2005. In the early 1990s, he served as Nepal's permanent representative to the UN, as vice chairman of the UN Disarmament Committee, and also as vice chairman of the UN Special Committee Against Apartheid. And at present, he is also the executive chairman of Kathmandu's Center for Democracy and Development. Jaya has also been a fellow at Harvard Center for International Affairs, a recipient of Fulbright grants, and has taught at the National Staff College of Nepal and Kathmandu's Trikulin University. He holds a PhD in linguistics from Georgetown as well. Now, in addition to this project report today, which of course will be about Nepal, we've put out on the table outside some other work that USIP has done on Nepal, so we invite you to take some of this literature, all of which can also be downloaded from our website, so I encourage you to visit that as well. This event will be recorded and available on the USIP website in about a week, so you're invited to listen to it again and again as many times as you like. And at this time, I'd like to formally thank Pushpa Iyer, who's the young lady who was checking everyone in as they entered, who's been Jaya's research assistant this year and has done a good deal of work to make this event possible. Pushpa, just received a PhD from George Mason's Conflict Analysis and Resolution Program and will be soon be joining the faculty of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Now that sound you just heard, not that sound, but the static is a result of cell phones and BlackBerries being on, so I'd like to kindly ask everyone if you can please turn yours off so that we don't have any interference in the microphone system. As far as how we proceed, I'll be very shortly turning the floor over to Jaya for about a half an hour presentation, and then we'll open up the floor to your questions and comments. So I think with that, we'll turn it over to
Jaya. Thank you, Lynn. It is really a great opportunity for me to be at USIP this year, as Nepal is passing through a very critical phase in its history, and people will decide in about 2 or 3 months when we are planning to have a constituent assembly elections. Which will decide upon many important things, including the institution of monarchy in Nepal, which has been there for the last 250 years or so. This series of events was caused by the Maoist insurgency, beside many other things. Nepal being very susceptible to international pressures throughout its history, also experienced a lot of diplomatic pressure as it passed through through the period of difficulties last year. So when I came here and told the topic of my project to my friends, Nepal's Maoist Insurgency Diplomatic Approaches for Resolution, the first question I was asked by them is, do the Nepalese Maoists get help from China? Or where does their support come from? Where do they get their arms and money? And some of the friends also asked me, how come that the greatest fighters of the world, the Gurkha soldiers, in the Royal Nepal Army, now Nepal Army, could not quell the insurgency, because they do such a good job everywhere where they are. And the third set of questions is, do the Maoists really mean peace? What makes them come to the peace negotiations? Was there some internal pressure on them, or some external, or the diplomatic pressures on them as well as on the king? My presentation today is focused on the third question, the diplomatic approaches to the resolution of Nepal's Maoist insurgency. And I will focus on the diplomatic approaches of India, the United States, and China, three most important and influential countries as far as Nepal's foreign relations are concerned. I mean, outside this paper, I also talk a little about the influence of the United Kingdom, which has the longest diplomatic relations with Nepal, beginning in 1816, and the United Nations, very important world body, European Union, Switzerland, another landlocked country in Europe, and World Bank and Japan, which is the largest donor in Nepal. But that's outside the scope of my presentation today. I'll focus only on India, USA, and China. I will give you the summary of the paper in the next 2-3 minutes, the three countries used as their diplomatic strategies, and then I will elaborate a little bit afterwards. The main points of this paper is that King Gyanendra, who is the 11th generation king after his ancestors unified Nepal in the second half of the 18th century, lost power, particularly because after his February 1, 2005 takeover, because by doing so he forced the political parties, the parliamentary political parties, the mainstream centrist parties, to align with the Maoists, ignoring the advice given to him by the Indian, U.S., American, and other friends of Nepal. The second point of this paper is that the Indian diplomatic efforts to bring about the seven-party alliance and Maoist understanding opened the peace process and began the restoration of democracy. The third point to remember is that the American diplomatic approach of coordinating efforts with the regional power, that is India, worked better this time than a unilateral approach or avoidance of dialogue would. Before the takeover, February takeover, the international pressure, the King's takeover, the international pressure was on the Maoists to disarm themselves and come to the mainstream. After the King took over on January 1st, 2005, the international pressure was on him, on the King, because every friend of Nepal felt that the King's step or takeover was a wrong, politically wrong step. And everybody urged him as much as they could to correct it as soon as possible. But the kings are kings. He did not listen, and eventually what happened was that the parliamentary political parties who were struggling to restore multi-party democracy by restoring the parliament were forced to join and build an alliance with the Maoists and signed a 12-point agreement or understanding in November 2005, and then in April 2006 there were so huge public protests, rallies in Kathmandu and other important cities that the king had to accept the demands of the political parties and restore the parliament. The three countries, India, the USA and China. Indian diplomatic approach was seen to be a five-pronged approach. I could call it even pentagonal approach. First, India tried to reconcile the constitutional monarchy and parliamentary democracy with each other as the two pillars of stability, peace and stability in Nepal. At the same time, India also used another diplomatic strategy of putting pressure on the king as much as it could by demanding the restoration of democracy, human rights, freedom of press, etc., civil liberties, and build and establish normal situation in the country. A third approach was that India, being the largest and almost sole military hardware and training supplier to Nepal, continued having relations with the army, Nepal army, because India was also concerned that Nepal army was also receiving military assistance from other countries than India itself. For example, the United States, UK, and some weapons were also purchased from Belgium, and part of the regular, although nominal, assistance, military assistance, China was also. So India was a bit concerned about that, and they need to keep the balance in their favor. And the fourth strategy India used was to put the pressure on the Maoists themselves. And the fifth was when the king did not listen to the advice, they started facilitating meetings and dialogues between the Seven Party Alliance, SPA, and the Maoists in Delhi. In contrast to the five-pronged Indian diplomatic approach, the American approach was four-point approach, diplomatic approach. The first was military assistance to Nepal army. And the second was putting pressure on the king to restore democracy. The third was indirect pressure on the Maoists by putting them on the terrorist watch list and strengthening Nepal army with military aid. Incidentally, you may know that the State Department has not taken off the terrorist tag from the Maoists, although they have joined the government, and they have also registered their weapons with the United Nations. The fourth strategy that was seen used by the U.S. Ambassador and other diplomats was to bring the king and political parties to reconciliation, which unfortunately didn't work until the peace movement forced the king to restore the parliament. The Chinese diplomatic approach was also four-pronged. Traditionally, Chinese have been supporting the king for their own reason. Even during the Cold War, during the 60s and 70s and 80s, China, it may sound paradoxical to many, was supporting the king for their own reason, which I will come back and explain toward the end of his paper. And China, as I said, was also supplying the military assistance to Nepal and the Nepal army, although it seemed recently that it was okay with the in consultations with India, not without consulting India. Then the third approach Chinese adopted was calling for reconciliation between the king and the political parties, which other powers also did. And finally, China really, you know, expressed a clear message for reconciliation between the king and political parties. So China moved from its sole dependence on the king to and his ability to restore peace, democracy, and everything in Nepal, to the king reconciling with the political parties. So it was a gradual move from, you know, the king to the political parties. Let me go back to the Indian approach and explain a little bit. As I said, the key element of Indian policy on Nepal was the idea that constitutional monarchy and multi-party democracy were the two pillars of stability. Even before King took over, there was a conference supposedly sponsored by the Indian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which was addressed by the Indian Foreign Secretary Sham Sharan, who said, "The Maoists want to abolish monarchy. They want to abolish multi-party democracy. So you have to make sure that the system survives, the system of constitutional monarchy and parliamentary democracy." These overtures, I mean, these messages probably were not heeded. The king took over, I mean, after this conference that was held sometime in December 2004, in February 2005, the king took over. India responded promptly because it refused to participate in the SAARC summit. SAARC is a South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation that was to be held just about 1 week after that. And because of India's refusal, the summit was postponed. If the king was sensitive enough, this was a message enough, strong message enough, that it was a disapproval from India, and he could possibly not rule the country without the support or moral, political, and logistic support from India, because those who have been in South Asia, in Nepal, and India know how much our dependency on India is. But he took over, and 1 month after the king's takeover, his foreign minister visited New Delhi and met with the Indian External Affairs Minister Natwar Singh, who told the king, according to the press release issued by the Indian Embassy in Kathmandu on March 7th, let me read one or two sentences from the press release. External Affairs Minister conveyed to Nepali Foreign Minister India's disappointment, I would like to underline that word, at the measures taken by His Majesty the King of Nepal, which had served not only to deepen the crisis facing Nepal. He also pointed out that it was not only India, but several other friends of Nepal which had expressed grave concern over these measures, which could endanger the institution of monarchy itself. I think the foreign minister, despite the need for being diplomatic, could not be clearer or stronger than this. And as the unfolding events showed, the king lost all the power. Now, the king is not regarded even as the head of the state. That position has been given to the interim prime minister. And the foreign diplomats presenting their credentials presented it to now to the prime minister, not to the king. So that was how it evolved. And as I said, India, although it stopped its military supplies immediately after the king's takeover, after a month or two, certain supplies were delivered because they were in the pipeline previously agreed upon. And the third pressure, the third strategy, as a part of the third strategy, India also started putting pressure on the Maoists, arresting them, putting them in prison in India, Indian jails, and also extraditing some of them to the legal authorities. That was pressure enough on the Maoists who had been moving freely in India, because most of you know that Nepal and India have an open border, opener than Canada-USA border, much opener. You don't need anything to cross the border, not passport, no ID, nothing. So it was easy, but then the Indian government started cracking down on them. Then the final and most important component of Indian diplomacy was facilitation of the Seven Party Alliance and the Maoist reconciliation of dialogue in Delhi. There were newspaper reports that the Maoist leaders were visiting India, Delhi. Particularly striking was the meeting between the second top Maoist leader, Dr. Baburam Bhattarai, and Prakash Karat, one of the Communist Party leaders in Indian Parliament. They were classmates in Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi in the 70s. Report of these two communist leaders meeting in Delhi was a sensational report published both in Indian newspapers and Kathmandu newspapers. There were denials and then confirmations, reconfirmations, and it was very controversial. And these meetings and other activities became so controversial that no other than the Indian Prime Minister himself, Dr. Manmohan Singh, had to defend the Indian government's initiatives by saying that supporting democracy was not meddling in Nepal's affairs. He said that to the journalists, international journalists based in New Delhi. The largest Communist Party leaders of Nepal, they are called UML, United Marxist Leninists, they were visiting Delhi. Madhav Kumar Nepal was visiting, Mahadev Gautam was visiting, and many other leaders. And the current Prime Minister, who was then the President of Nepali Congress, G.P. Koirala, met. And in modern times, probably it's impossible to keep the secrets or anything. I mean, the media is so pervasive, its eyes. These meetings were not secret meetings or behind the screen meetings, they became public. So this was going on in Delhi, and as a result of these meetings, the Seven Party Alliance of the Maoists signed a 12-party agreement, which is a watershed of agreements in Nepal's history that changed everything, and probably it will change more things in the future. I think Nepal is not going to remain the same old Nepal anymore. A lot of things will change. The American diplomatic approach, as I said, was marked by four features: military aid to Nepal Army, putting pressure on the king, and indirect pressure on the Maoists, and efforts to forge an alliance between the king and the political parties, not between the political parties and the Maoists. That was where the difference was between the Indian approach and the American approach. Secretary of State Colin Powell visited Nepal. He was the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Nepal in the history of the two countries. He met with the king and the prime minister, and the next day he met with also the Nepal Army chief. After his visit in January 2002, in May, Nepalese prime minister visited the White House, and he was also the first prime minister to visit any U.S. president in the White House in May 2002. Subsequently, the U.S. government promised to supply about 20,000 M-16 rifles and two Huey Cobra helicopters as military aid to Nepal. However, I think consultations with the Indian security establishment, after the king's takeover, some 3,500 guns were held back, because everybody realized that the king and the army loyal to him was not going to necessarily win the insurgency, defeat the insurgency militarily. Pressure on the king. Ambassador Moriarty, I think, met after he took over, the king took over, Ambassador Moriarty met King Gyanendra almost every month. I think in one of the weekly newspapers meeting, he told that he met almost 12 or 13 times. He persuaded the king to restore multi-party democracy and reach out the political parties. He didn't. Unusual in Nepal-U.S. relations, many senior senators, Senator Richard Lugar, Joseph Biden, Chuck Hagel, Patrick Leahy, wrote to Condoleezza Rice, and they followed on. They wrote to the king himself. I have quoted, given series of meetings and press statements of the American diplomats and high-ranking officials. Christina Rocha visited many times. Donald Camp visited many times. They issued statements which a wise king should have read very carefully and corrected, but he didn't. And the reconciliation that was requested by all diplomats did not come. As I said before, the U.S. government also put the Maoists on the terrorist watch list, and they are still on the list. However, they have come to the power, to the government, although a small component in the coalition government, but they have a very strong popular basis. Whether it is true or it is based on the intimidation, terror, or whatever they have spread in the country, has to be seen. The final part of the Chinese diplomacy, as I said, was in the beginning, the Chinese were very confident that the king would be able to bring peace and order in the country. The words the Chinese diplomats used was that after the king's takeover, the Chinese diplomats, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said, Nepal is a friendly country, and whatever has happened in Nepal is an internal affairs, and we hope that the Nepalese group and people will be able to forge their path ahead for the for peace and prosperity, something like that. I mean, very non-committal. China did provide some military aid, as I said before, in 1988-89, Chinese military assistance, although the weapons were purchased, said to be purchased by the Nepal government, caused concern in India, and India had imposed blockade against Nepal as a punitive measure, and that had resulted in the termination of the king's direct rule. But again, China did provide military assistance, this time also in 2005. Nepal army chief went to Beijing and had a meeting with General Liang Guangli of China, and about $1 million worth of weapons were given to Nepal. But then it looked as if the Chinese were gradually realizing the need for the king to reach out the political parties also. And the statement of the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson indicated that, because the spokesperson said that there was a need for the king and the political parties to reconcile. At the final stroke of this realization, in mid-March 2006, that was just about a month before the April uprisings, State Councillor of the People's Republic of China, Tang Jiasun, visited Kathmandu and met with a wide range of opposition party leaders. Chinese leadership were very careful not to meet with the opposition party leaders ever before. But this time, he met with a lot of opposition party leaders, and addressing a large audience of the political party leaders and diplomats in Kathmandu, he said, "We sincerely hope that all the constitutional forces in Nepal will set store by the fundamental interest of the country and people and seek to appropriately settle the current difficulties and problems through dialogues based on the maintenance of Nepal's independence, sovereignty and territorial unification or unity." So one month after that, there were April uprisings, and that was the final act in the Nepalese political and diplomatic exercises. We have read just a couple of days ago that the government of Nepal has decided the date for Constituent Assembly in November. It will all depend on the law and order situation, which is still very fluid in the country. I think I should stop here.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. I've got a few questions of my own, but I'd like to open it up to the audience, because Jaya has had the opportunity to talk with me quite frequently. So does anyone have any questions to start off with, or comments? Maybe we need a couple minutes to think about this presentation, but then that gives me the luxury of asking you some of my questions without any guilt, which is, first of all, I think you've done an excellent job of laying out the sort of three major international powers' strategies with respect to Nepal, and I wonder if you have anything you could say about the relations between these three powers, China, India and the U.S., and how they dealt with each other with respect to Nepal. If there's anything interesting about this relationship, or any lessons to be learned, whether it's how the three engage with each other, or how they engage with Nepal. Now, because of reasons of time, Jaya wasn't really able to talk more than about these three powers of the Archangel are all related to two. I wonder if you have any kind of general thoughts you could give us about the role of other international actors like the UN, other states, that I think that could enlighten your presentation. I think I had another question, but maybe I'll just stop right there.
Okay. I think that's a very good question for us Nepalese also to think. Nepal won its freedom first in 1951 from its own internal dictatorial rule of the Ranas, who ruled the country as absolute prime ministers and the shoguns of Japan for 100 years. That was also the end of the Cold War, the Second World War, and the beginning of the Cold War. And these three powers that you mentioned, and I dealt with, China, India, and USA, in Nepal, had particular interest in Nepal. India and China both still have strategic interest, because whatever happens in Nepal affects them directly. And whatever happens in India or China also affects us, the Nepalese, directly. I put also the American interest in Nepal not at the same strategic level, but at very high political stake there. During the Cold War, the relations between India and the Soviet Union on one hand, and the relations between the USA and China on the other. So there were four powers at cross connections, and Nepal had to balance its relations among the four. Not converging their interests the same way in Nepal. The United States of America also supported the king, even at the cost of democracy during the Cold War, for its own reason. And surprisingly, as I said, or paradoxically, the Chinese also supported the king himself, but were the American and the Chinese interests the same in Nepal? Probably, the American support for the king was in view of Nepal's position vis-a-vis China. And Chinese support to the king in Nepal was in view of its relations vis-a-vis India and the West. So the Chinese thought that the king was the bulwark, the institution of monarchy was the bulwark against any international intervention, interference, especially that of India and the rest of the world. Probably they supported the king for their own diplomatic and strategic reasons. Now, in 2006, the situation is 2007. The situation is totally different. All these three countries are coming closer, and three very large countries, the two largest neighbors of Nepal and the sole superpower of the world. Their relations are much better and coming closer to each other, and probably the king, the father of the present king, who maneuvered Nepal's foreign relations, putting them on a delicate balance, did not have the same maneuverability in the later years. Now, I think we have to set our foreign policy agenda in a totally different context. In one way, Nepal does not feel the threat to its existence as it did in the past, because all the important world powers that are important for us have a common interest in our peace, stability, and democracy in the country, because any disturbance in the country has implications both regional and to some extent global. So I think all the three powers, as I mentioned in the paper also, are working together on Nepal, not on conflicting agenda or conflicting issues, but common issues, issues of democracy, stability, peace, and social and economic development, which is in the enlightened interest of everyone in Nepal, India, China, and the United States. And second question, United Nations. United Nations, after all, is a world body, and it doesn't have its own power or ability to do anything unless its member states want to do anything about it, particularly the five P's, permanent members of the Security Council. Two of them, India, China and USA, I have already spoken about their role. Even for the United Nations, I should mention that even for the United Nations, it was possible to do anything only in consultations with India. India having such exclusive leverage on Nepal. Given UN interest in Kashmir since the late 1940s or early 50s, India probably had certain reservations on UN involvement in Nepal, which would kind of set a precedent of UN involvement in the region. But to the extent that was clearly spelled out in the letters written to the United Nations by the Prime Minister and the Maoist leader, India had no objection to the United Nations coming as a peace monitor, not peacekeeper, a civilian peace monitor and monitor of human rights and monitor of the agreements that were signed between the two parties, warring parties, as the United Nations staying there as witness.
Okay, great, thank you. I see, now we have lots of hands. I think John was, you weren't, okay. Let's start with you then, if you could state your name, your affiliation. You and then this gentleman here, and I think I saw a hand was on the side. Okay, how about the lady in the back? We'll start with three, and then we'll continue after that. So please, go ahead.
Center for International Comparative Law, University of Baltimore. I have three brief questions, if I may. The first one relates to developments in Bhutan and whether you care to make any observations contrasting or comparing recent events in Bhutan to the undergoing process in Nepal. The second question I have is that it seems to me that two of the cornerstones of any democracy are, number one, the citizenry's right to vote, because that's how we express our political opinion, one way, and the other one, an independent judiciary. And I was wondering if you could offer any observations as to how these two points fare in the present development. And the third question I have relates to what you've already just covered in your last remark, and that's Kashmir. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit further, not specific to the United Nations, but to the ongoing discussion now between India and Pakistan on Kashmir, and whether that process may cast its influence in the direction of Nepal.
Thank you, sir.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. A very small question. Army in Nepal has been totally loyal to the king for generations and generations. This transformation and the changes which are taking place suddenly, what are the army and the king's relations now, and what would be the relation between the army and the new all-body army?
Okay, thank you. The lady in the back.
My name is Carla White, and I work for the European Project. I was interested in the uprising that you discussed as the tipping point for the people's power. I'm wondering if you could give us some ideas about
you, but we'll start with these three questions. I think that's quite a lot, and then we'll move on from there. I think already one hand. And if you can just signal to me, and I'll keep my eye.
Bhutan, the situation there is fluid, but to tell you frankly, under very much control of India, with which Bhutan has a 1949 treaty saying that Bhutan will accept the advice of India on foreign relations and defense matters. And recently that treaty was revised, but the revised treaty had a rider which said that Bhutan will never establish diplomatic relations with the permanent five members of the United Nations. That includes China. So Bhutan is also promulgating a new constitution, and the Bhutanese are exercising their voting voting rights, so to say. There were some mock election sessions held for the Bhutanese people, but everybody knows that there are some 100,000 refugees of Nepalese origin in Bhutan, from Bhutan, who are in Nepal, and some of them in India, and they have been there for 17 years. The international community has not been able to do much. Recently, the American government has offered to take 60,000 of them for the settlement in this country. But again, for some reason, people are protesting against that, and I don't know. I mean, how things are moving. Some other countries, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and some European countries have also offered to take them and settle this refugee problem that has been raging for 17 years. In Nepal, the two questions that you asked: the citizens' right to vote and independent judiciary. People of Nepal have enjoyed and exercised their right to vote in the last two or three parliamentary elections. They were free from controversy, and they were certified by international observers from all over the world as free and fair elections. But then the question is, how come that despite such exercise of democracy, the Maoist insurgency started in 1996? I think the government strapped from resources, resources strapped as it was for social and economic development programs, could not move fast enough to address the issues of poverty and ethnic and regional imbalances fast enough, so that the Maoists, looking for an opportunity for insurgency, could cash on these issues which remained inadequately addressed. In the judiciary in Nepal is fairly independent. I may say that the king, after he took over in February 2005, instituted a commission called Royal Commission for Corruption Control, RCCC. Somebody filed a writ petition in the Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of such a commission, in a way challenging the king. And the Supreme Court overturned the king's decision and unconstitutionalized the commission, and it was immediately dissolved. All its files and works were burnt or buried or something. I take it as an example of Supreme Court's ability to act even at that level in that way. Kashmir, India, it is a too complicated thing for me to comment on, Kashmir, the dialogue between India and Pakistan. I mean, needs to focus on it for his life, probably, and understand it. But we in Nepal only hope that this issue will be resolved by the statesmen of the two countries, because in a way we are also affected by the Kashmir issue in Nepal, because there are a lot of Kashmiri refugees in Kathmandu doing business, and of course, I mean, the weak government in Nepal cannot always monitor the business that goes on there, and sometimes something may happen. For example, I think there was a plane hijack case by some Kashmiri militants.
IC 813.
I mean, we do not want such events to take place at all, at least from our soil. Nepal wants to remain really, I mean, free from these troubles. So we pray sincerely that this issue, Kashmir issue, is resolved. It will be for the tremendous benefit of Nepal, not only Nepal, for India and Pakistan, which will again start a new chapter in the history of subcontinent, I hope. Going to Colonel Dutta's questions, Nepal Army's loyalty to the king, that's true. I mean, until 2006, April 2006, it was called Royal Nepal Army. They have just dropped the word royal, but they have not dropped anything from their mind. And the question remains, how much of the loyalty of the army is turned towards the civilian or interim government? That's a good question. And I don't think it will change, the attitude will change overnight. That is one of the things which keeps Nepal's situation fluid. The Maoists are demanding that their combatants be integrated into the army, Nepal army, so that the process would change the color of the army, at least dilutes its composition. There are a lot of technical questions involved in it. How many of the armies, the combatants are qualified, really qualified to be enlisted as soldiers? According to the UN reports, almost 9,000 of them, 9,000 out of 30,000 are underage, they are child soldiers, they are below the age of 18 or so. That is a very important and serious question, and I have expressed my view somewhere else that if we do not solve this issue in Nepal, we may unfortunately fall in similar situation as in Pakistan or Bangladesh. Once the monarchy is gone and the army is not loyal to the civilian government as it is in India, then its role may be something like that in Pakistan or India, which will be very unfortunate for the Nepalese Democrats.
Could I, with the permission of moderator, add the writer to it?
Yeah.
Because the major portion of Nepalese export and the foreign exchange earning comes from the army, the recruitment to the British army, as well as to the Indian army. Mm-hmm. Now, if this element, which is uncertain element, disloyal element, has corrected, would that affect the recruitment to the British army and the Indian army? Because certain recruitment may take place out of these mixing up of rebels, Maoists.
That's another good question. But you know that the British recruitment and Indian recruitment does not take place within the Royal Nepal Army. It is not from within the army. It is from outside the existing Nepalese army that the young men are recruited for the British Gurkha Brigade.
And that's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. But yesterday, Maoist Supreme Leader Prachanda, giving an interview to some Indian television station, said that he wants to maintain special relations, quote-unquote, special relations with India. he seems to have realized how extensive the relations between the two countries are. In this context, it may not be possible to disrupt or disturb the ongoing, you know, tradition of recruitment in the two foreign armies. And why the April 2006? I think that was a culmination of the 12-point agreement between the Seven-Party Alliance and the Maoists that took place in November 2005. December, January, February. From January on, there were street demonstrations in Kathmandu, because these street demonstrations were the results of the understanding between the Seven-Party Alliance and the Maoists. But the final days, it is said that the Maoists were able to bring in lots of people from outside the Kathmandu city, from the neighboring districts, and show unmanageable people power in front of the king, which forced him to restore the parliament. So there is a feeling that the final day was decided by what the Maoists were able to do. In bringing, they threatened to bring about 2 million people in the street, but even half a million people out in the street would change things in the power. And I don't think they brought even half a million. It was just about 100,000 to a couple of 100,000 people.
And their organizational capacity to do that, because the way I understood it, the Maoists were little factions, isolated factions.
No, the Maoists themselves did not. Of course, there are 7 or 8 communist parties in Nepal. The largest one is in the parliament, in the Nepal Communist Party, UML, United Marxist Leninist. But over the 10 years of insurgency, I think the Maoists were able to build popular support, whether real popular support or support based on intimidation, extortion, fear, or whatever. Because the rural Nepal is very inaccessible by transportation and communication, means of transportation and communication. It is easy to build any organization in rural Nepal. So it was not. They were not that factionalized. They are pretty much united so far. Although there were rumors that some of them defected, like just about 1 month before the final April 2006 uprisings, the two very important leaders of the Maoist party defected and criticized the top leaders. That was in the newspapers. But so far, the organization seems to be intact.
Thank you. Let's have our next round of questions, beginning with you, and then to you, and then finally to you. And I see if you can keep your hands up. Okay, and I'll remember you for the next round. Okay, so let's start with you.
My name is Sangeeta Sial. I'm from Nepal, and currently I work as deputy director of the Microcredit Summit campaign. My main question has to do with, you referred in your talk that Nepal will never be the same, that the future looks very different. I'm curious to hear what that future looks like. And secondly, I know that there are ethnic clashes that are going on now, so Nepal isn't as much covered by the Western media because it's not the same kind of Maoist issues that are going on. But to what extent do you think that's going to change the nature and atmosphere in Nepal, just like the Maoists did? Will it have irreversible consequences?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Adam Kaplan. I work for USAID. Building on the question of associate over here, it was my understanding that the April uprising, while initiated by the Maoists, was able to tap into genuine disagreements and genuine issues with the lack of social justice, and that this is really what propelled the hundreds of thousands of people into the street that was ultimately able to unseat the king and move towards the parliament. So my question is, given that there is this core social justice agenda that seems to radiate and is at least a significant portion of the Maoist support, what do you see as the present SPA, the other political parties' response to that social justice agenda? This builds on what the future might be for Nepal. And what do you see as the role of the diplomatic community in bringing that future about?
Okay,
that's
great. Thank you. And then one more question.
Sure. I have two questions. One is the public engagement is from the government side, that the government has failed to do. Therefore, there are all kinds of ethnic uprising and so forth, and how to manage that expectation. And then my second question, I'll come back to my question. My second question is that it seems clear to me from my own experience, and then visiting Nepal every year for the last 12 years and talking to people in villages, and also speaking with political party leaders and so forth, the country has clearly moved toward democratic republic. And the example is that from the 75 districts, Nepali Congress district level presidents, Jempa Kathmandu, convened 74 of them voiced their support for the republic, and only one did not. While that is happening at the leadership level of the Nepali Congress Party, they have not actually clarified whether they stand for the republic, or they somehow still are attached to some concept of monarchy in Nepal, which seems to me that goes completely against what the spirit of the country is. And my first question was that in time of transition, public needs to be engaged. While political parties are talking to each other and seeing other by and so forth, I think people feel like they have been left behind. And so what are the ways, some of the ways, I think it would be the international community maybe come in handy in terms of facilitating that process, but what can the government do at this point to engage the people so that the agenda, the public agenda, also fits into the national agenda, which, after the Constituent Assembly in November, would have to be developed.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Could you, actually, I didn't catch your name in your...
Omraj Acharya.
Oh, okay. Great, thank you.
It is pretty obvious Nepal will not remain the same. Even the Nepalese diaspora in this country has not remained the same. When I was a student at Georgetown University, we were hardly 125 people in Virginia, Maryland, and DC area. Now there are almost 100,000 Nepalese in this country. Speaking out, different languages, different, and they have their TV and radio stations and newspapers and lobby efforts and everything that is going on. So has Nepal changed there, and is changing. The main change is between the monarchy, constitutional monarchy, and the republic. As Hooda's Acharya has said, the country is heading towards the republic. The question now remains, in this newly established republic, will the ethnic and social divisions and clashes be able to resolve the issues without tearing the country apart? That's the biggest question. Because in the heart of Europe, we have seen what happened in Yugoslavia. My hope is that Nepal will not go the same way for both internal and external regions. Internally, The Nepalese people seem to have developed a sense of nationhood or nationality or nationalism, whatever you call it. Because even the Tharai leaders who are leading these movements speak the same language in such a way that they almost sound like the government leaders bargaining for something. The use of Nepali language, beside the institution of monarchy and the ability of the army to keep the country together, over the years, over the decades, it seems that Nepal has been able to develop one binding element, that is Nepali language. Whether you are in Bumla or Mugu or in Jhapa, everybody converses in Nepali. I think that is a tribute to the nation builders who used the language as a common binding force for the country. Look at the diversity of the background of the American people. But from Maine to California or from Oregon to Florida, everybody speaks English. I think language is a big binding force. But the picture will be different because the people will be different socially, economically, politically, and we are talking about creating autonomous regions in the country. We don't know how much of autonomic power each region will be given. But the question remains, how will the central power and authority and the autonomous regional powers remain balanced so that the country does not fall apart? The Maoists were not able to enlist the support of the people only on the basis of social inequalities and imbalances. No. Their agenda was clearly a communist political theoretical agenda. They worked on it. It was not social, ethnic, or cultural agenda, because their literature and their public pronouncements, speeches, have not given any picture of the new Nepal that they would create with resolving these social issues. Not that they are not there, they are poverty. And my usual complaint to our best friends and the greatest friends and the friends who have tremendous capacity to help us is that this issue of social development, economic development, remained in the back burner even during the Cold War decades. If you look at the statistics of US aid from 1960 to 1990, it comes around 12 to 13 million dollars a year annually. In a country which is strategically and politically located in such a sensitive place and with such poverty, I think American aid and attention was less than adequate during the past. Even after the restoration of democracy in 1990, this issue was not sufficiently put forward either by the Nepalese leaders of post-democracy Nepal, or probably not adequately understood by the American diplomats or authorities there. I think there is a serious agenda for us to work on it in the future, and I think we have to address this issue of social advancement together aggressively. Ironically, the Maoist insurgency started in the Rapti zone, where there was a big USAID program in the 70s. It left so many issues unearthed but unaddressed. It dug up those issues but left unaddressed. Let's not repeat that in the future. I think the future ambassador, U.S. ambassador in Kathmandu, and people like you in the USAID have a very serious and important agenda ahead of us.
We have an agenda.
That's sure. I mean, that the agenda is, I mean, to address this social issue that remained unaddressed in the last 40 years.
Let me follow up on a question.
Yeah.
I guess I agree with you, and I understand that there were core problems that were left unaddressed over the previous decades. I guess my question is focused more on the future and focused more on the role that the Nepali political system that is equally as culpable in the lack of delivery of services to the historically disenfranchised in Nepal. How can we assist the Nepali people build a political system that can allow them to address their own needs? And to what degree can we assist all political parties, and potentially Maoists included, if they come off the terrorist list, to not simply give lip service to the idea of this development agenda, but actually reach out to Humla and Rakti and these areas that have been historically disenfranchised?
Okay. If democracy had not been scuttled by the father of the present king in 1960, probably the process of enfranchisement and integration of the nation in modern terms would continue, and probably this situation would not remain. Aggravating the problem that is already there because of the geographic condition of the country, what the kings, the father of the present king and his older brother, did in 30 years from 60 to 90 was leave these regions and people untouched. The development issue remained unaddressed. So even if we had tried our best after 1990, the post-democratic leaders, it would definitely take much longer time. For one example is that they set a goal of reaching each district headquarters by motor car road. You know how daunting a task that is. It is a kind of wishful thinking. But the people do demand, and even an illiterate woman in Humla or Jumla will say, once you bring the road to us, it will bring everything, the health facilities and schools and communication and everything. I mean, in a way, she's right when she says so. Building the democratic structure of the country, of course, it is a very difficult question, and of course, it will have to. I mean, we will have to keep the balance between the center and the autonomous regions. We do not want Nepal to fall apart. My own proposal is that let us divide those five regional development regions. As autonomous regions, not based on ethnic or linguistic or religious groups, but on geographic regions. And let us equitably distribute the national resources to the five development councils, elected bodies of 25 persons of elders each, and let them decide which way they want to build the road or build schools or hospitals. And let's give them full autonomy, as in this country, except in foreign relations and defense and minting dollars. I mean, printing dollars. I think most of the American states, 50 states, enjoy as much autonomy as they want. So maybe we can create a little United States in the Himalayas with that sort of. That sort of structure, political structure.
Yeah. Okay. I think
public engagement. Yes.
Yeah. I to just touch base on that. I think one of the things that that needs to happen to come out with certain ways how the country should move forward would be to engage the people through national conversation. And then the international community would have a greater role in terms of facilitating that. You know, there are so many NGOs, you know, civil societies, and even the government, in the Peace and Reconstruction Ministry, can lead the charge and then bring all the communities together, village by village. I mean, that has to happen. Otherwise, we'll repeat the same issue, even before the Constitutional Assembly or right after it. Before the national agenda is set, I think we need to be thinking about that. And I think the international community has a greater role to play. Maybe, you know, USIP could do something. Regarding that. Actually, I'm presenting a paper on this issue in Los Angeles on July in front of, you know, about 1,000 Nepali people who will be gathered there, who will be talking about that. So
I agree. I think knowingly or unknowingly, or I mean, the Nepalese government leaders are making efforts to engage the public. The Nepal indigenous peoples organization leaders are talking to with Ramchandra Pawdel, the Peace and Reconstruction Minister, and the signs are that they are not talking about breaking the country apart. They are talking about fair and equitable representation of these communities in the national politics. That is what I mean, internal dimensions of this politics, and also external interest. Nobody is interested, I hope, I think nobody is interested in Nepal being, interested in seeing Nepal fall apart, especially our two neighbors and the superpowers. So that's a good sign, and I think this film public engagement dialogue is going on, and every day I read the newspapers and the websites of newspapers. I feel kind of assured that Nepal may not fall off the precipice. Maybe save itself.
Yeah, yeah? I was just thinking of that kind of engagement.
Okay.
Let's have another round of questions, starting with this gentleman here, and then on the side. And
thank you, Hans. Okay. Eric Picard with USAID. Thank you for your presentation. Very fascinating. Just a quick question. This gentleman, Mr. Acharya, touched on civil society as well. Civil society has many forms. One of the institutions that USAID has been supported for some time, what we think is considerable success, is the community parks and user groups and other natural resource user groups. And that's one way to empower communities to manage their natural resources, and by so doing, come together and develop a form of democratic self-government. I'm curious what you think about that, and also the role of labor in Nepali politics and this whole process, because recently they were able to sort of flex their muscles and prevented a World Bank effort to change the labor laws and going ahead.
Okay, thank you.
I'm William Ferrajaro. I'm a political analyst and a consultant on freedom of information and rule of law. I guess my question is, again, kind of a civil society kind of question. I wondered, I apologize for being late, but I wondered if you haven't addressed this already, if you could talk about the role of media development and the role of freedom of expression in enhancing the democratization of the call.
Okay, all right, great, thanks. And let's have one more question before we.
Yeah.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Mona Dabe, the National Endowment for Democracy. My question, unfortunately, is away from the society question, but the future of Nepal seems to be on hold, obviously, until the November 22nd elections. I wondered if you envision any threats or could identify any factors that you could imagine would destabilize the progress and the process moving forward in the next 4 months until we can get to a point where we can look at Nepal's future and how that structure might be.
Okay. Let me start from the last and go back, right? The only threat is the continuation of violence by the YCL, Young Communist League, and other groups. And I have a deep-seated fear that people may not be able to vote in a free and fair election without being intimidated. That is a prerequisite, and if that is made sure, that is ensured, things may progress on the right track. That is the only fear. Other things will be resolved in the course of events. And civil society, yes, I think despite the lack of literacy in the country, you know, Nepal has just about 50-55% literate people, despite the improbable physical conditions in the country, which is such a difficult, such a difficult mountainous terrain, communication has been a revolution. There are about 22 FM radio stations in Kathmandu Valley itself. I mean, three small cities in the valley, populated by some 2 million, 2.5 million people. Despite beside the national radio and several TV channels broadcast from Kathmandu. And if you look at the newspapers, if you have visited Kathmandu, if democracy in 1990, restoration of democracy, had resulted in any positive thing, that is the development of the media, the newspapers. They have high quality newspapers, both in English and Nepali. The young men who are working hard as journalists have put out such wonderful reports. The photographs of the violence that took place. They have visited remote regions and reported back in Kathmandu, and the stories are published. And despite the king's takeover in February 1, 2005, and despite the emergency that he imposed, and despite the restriction on freedom of press that he imposed, the press remained unaffected by whatever he asked. They continued to publish the stories of the repression, the excessive excesses caused by the army and the police. And if you visit the website of one British MP, Levitt, it is still there in his website. They visited Kathmandu just about 1 or 2 weeks before the final day of the April uprising. And he is all praise for the Nepalese press. He has. And they went and took a photograph with the speaker of the dissolved parliament, which had not met for 4 years. And that photograph was published by the local newspapers, who did not care whatever the king, or his administration. So I think media has played such a wonderful role. I'm only afraid that it may overplay its role. Otherwise, I am more than satisfied. And community forestry, that is one success story of USAID program. I mean, there are not many, but community forestry is great. You know, in the 80s, they were talking about Nepal turning into a mountain desert. Today, I was flown by a friend of mine over the mountains in a helicopter. All mountains are green. There is hardly any mountain which you see brown or naked. Now, that is a community forestry program. Another successful program would be in the field of education, which has not taken place. I cry and I plead that this Fulbright scholarship program should be, enhanced and increased the quotas. There is a growing tendency of Fulbright scholar staying back here, unlike me, I mean, who returned back home. Instead, what I propose is that the British established a wonderful high school in Kathmandu in 1970. That is something comparable to Exeter or Phillips Academy here. The problem with that high school is also that all its graduates come here to go to Ivy League schools, and they say in this country, the country doesn't get much. Why doesn't USAID establish at least five such schools in five different development regions, so that the backward community kids can go to these schools and give something back to their own community? I think education is a long-term revolution process. It has a long-lasting impact, and I would urge the U.S. authorities to consider this idea very seriously.
Labor?
Yes.
The role of labor in
Nepal and politics. Yeah, role of labor. Again, labor movement in Nepal has been wonderful. The current prime minister himself started his political career as a labor leader in 1947 when he started started the movement in Biratnagar, his hometown. Again, I am afraid that labor movement may overdo itself and completely paralyze the economic machine. I mean, progress of the country. There is too much. We are not worried about too little. We are worried about too much.
Okay. I think we're about out of time now, but I'd like to thank Jaya for a great presentation.
Would you like to ask the last question, or we can talk?
If you have any questions, Jaya is staying afterwards, and please talk with him. But I'd like to thank you all for coming and for your questions.